Hello, and welcome to episode 79 of The Big Web Show, the award-winning web show on everything web that matters. How many times could I say web in this sentence? I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and my very special guest today is my friend and business associate, Eric Meyer, the godfather of CSS wisdom on the internet. Before we begin, I'd like to thank our sponsor, Shutterstock.com. Shutterstock.com is where you'll find over 20 million stock photos, vectors, illustrations, and video clips. Start your search at Shutterstock.com to find that perfect image for your website, ad, publication, or any other creative project. Shutterstock gives you a global image collection to find images from around the world to suit your project. Choose between image packs and monthly subscription packages, or if you just need one image for your blog or mockup, you can do that too. Sign up for a free account. Go to Shutterstock.com, no credit card needed. When you find the images you like and decide to purchase, use offer code BIGWEBSHOW1. That's BIGWEBSHOW number one, BIGWEBSHOW1, to get 30% off any package. Shutterstock, Shutterstock, Shutterstock. Thank you, Shutterstock. And thank you, Eric, for joining us. Hello, how are you?
Pretty good. How about you?
I'm very good. You're coming to us from lovely Cleveland Heights, Ohio.
I am.
And yes. you work out of a home studio, do you not?
I do. Yep. In fact, if we're really lucky, we might hear, you know, leaf blowers in the next door neighbor's yard or something like that while we're doing this.
You have three kids.
I do. Yeah.
And your wife is a professional. Uh-huh. So you're both professionals with three kids and you work at home. How do you stay sane and manage all that for starters?
I mostly concentrate on managing that. Staying sane is that falls off the priority list, I have to say.
Okay.
We have some part-time help and we have a lot of friends in the area who can help us out when, you know, things go south with scheduling or whatever. For me, it's not that bad. We, you know, I have my own sort of office space that I can close off. excuse me. But, you know, my eldest daughter is in third grade, so she's in school most of the day. Our younger children are in, our middle child is in pre-K this year, so she's got that all day. And then our youngest is in daycare in the same facility that she's doing her pre-K. So, you know, during the day, it's pretty quiet. Yeah, I can do that sort of thing. Where it gets more interesting, my wife, Kat, is a medical professional, and she actually works a couple of part-time jobs. One at a Minute Clinic, which is how I get to hear all kinds of fascinating stories, especially this year during flu season. And she also works for a clinic at one of our local hospitals on a part-time basis. And so sometimes she has to work late. And so, you know, on those evenings, I get to be, you know, sort of Mr. Mom, as it were, you know, cook dinner and get the kids to bed and that kind of thing. But, you know, our eldest is 9. She's a big help. The middle one's 4.5, so she's starting to, you know, come to the point of also being able to help. So it's, you know, I have a lot of help within the family as well as without the family. You know, sometimes we have friends over for dinner and they help with putting the kids to bed, and sometimes we don't. And
are there rules about not going into the office when dad's on the phone, or not going into the studio when dad's on Skype?
Right. I mean, yeah, when the office door is closed, then, you know, only knock on it if you're bleeding or on fire, basically. That kind of thing. But, you know, most of that sort of thing I do, you know, I try to make sure that that happens when they're not here, you know, when they're in school. So
you've managed, I believe, for the most part, to almost entirely to live your adult professional life almost entirely outside of traditional offices. In other words, you haven't, like most of us, ever been stuck going to an office, especially one owned by someone else.
Well, I mean, early on when I graduated college, I went to work for Case Western Reserve University, which was the college that had given me my degree. I figured that, you know, if I could work for them long enough to make back everything I had paid them in tuition, then that would, I would count that as a win. So, you know, I had an office there and I worked at the university. It was, certainly wasn't, you know, corporate cube farm working for, you know, massive international corporation kind of deal, but, you know, there's a lot of the same, you know, you can still have office politics at a university and that kind of stuff.
Were you a webmaster?
Yes, I was. I was actually the first sort of dedicated webmaster.
In the world?
No, at Case, sorry.
I know you're impressive, but...
No. And there had been a web server before that, but it was... okay, so we're gonna go back a bit. Kids, ask your parents about this. But way back in the day, there was this thing called Gopher.
Sure.
And some people refer to it as a precursor to the web. I think that's really more an accident of timing almost than anything else. It's just Gopher was the thing we were using when the web came along and mm-hmm. took off. But so we had a Gopher server, and there had been software written very early on when the web came that you could install on your Gopher server, and then you would serve up the Gopher pages as web pages. Like, they would just be automatically generated, and each page would be a list of links, like an unordered list of links, and you would click on one and it would get you to the next one. It was a lot like being on a BBS.
Were they really unordered lists? I mean, did they really conform
with good
practices of HTML back then?
Well, because you have to remember, this was pre-tables.
Right. It was pre-table layouts, exactly.
Well, I mean, it was pre-table markup.
Right.
At the time this happened, there was no, you know,
the table element didn't exist.
Right, exactly. Netscape 1.1 brought us the table element. And
Tim Berners-Lee didn't envision that we would ever have a need for a data table.
I don't know that he didn't envision it so much as he didn't feel that trying to specify that in the first version of HTML was a good move.
It was a nice to have, not a...
Well, and also it was a complicated to define, right? Like, to do right. If you look at the very early versions of HTML, they're very... The elements are very simple, and they're very focused on, you know, sort of putting in text. And so sometimes I don't want to speak for, you know, Tim, only he could do that. But sometimes I feel like the pre-element was sort of a, well, you know, sometimes we need to just take a, you know, we'll take a mainframe output that, you know, uses spaces to line up columns, and we can just blat that into this pre-element. We'll use a monospace font there, and then done, right? And then we'll figure out how to do actual tables later.
Wow, right. Okay.
Which, you know, because
I imagine he was a big fan of ASCII art too.
Possible. There was a lot of it around then.
You know, you say you don't want to speak for Tim, but one strange and defining aspect of your career is that you, although you didn't create CSS, at least as far as I know, you may have contributed to some versions, which I'd like to hear more about, but you've often been an interpreter of it, sort of translating it to, for example, when you and some others were involved in the CSS Samurai, telling browser makers what you thought CSS should do in complicated or edge cases where nobody knew what it should do. And just how is this just, I mean, is this just the way your mind works? How do you become, from a college student and a webmaster working at Case Western, how do you become an expert in something that doesn't even exist yet, you know, that's still sort of a spec without a, how do you become an expert in a spec that hasn't really been supported in browsers, first of all?
I think like most of us, it's an accident of timing and interest and placement, right? I happened to be exposed to the web really early. One of my coworkers, still a friend of mine named Jim Naur, who we see fairly often for dinner, actually. He showed me Mosaic. I don't even remember which version it was. It was one of the betas. It was before Mosaic 1.0. Right. And I said, wow. Right. Cause this was a version of Mosaic after Mark Andreessen had added the IMG element. So that whole thing had already happened. So inline images were now a part of the web. And that's the point at which I saw it, was probably in that brief window between you can put images in the page, but all you can do is put images in the page, right? Right. We hadn't yet hit the point of like floating them to the right or left or using a line, as which is what Netscape 1.1 did. You know, we didn't have tables.
And gutters were created by the browser.
Right. And you really had no control over them. As an author, you had no control over them as a, I don't remember if that's one of the things that Mosaic lets you control or not. And I suspect
as a user
wasn't as a user. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mosaic in the Mosaic preferences, the user could set the appearance of every element. And at least early versions of Opera did this. I don't know if they still do. I haven't dug around in the depths of their preferences for a while, but like you could literally, there was just a list of elements and like you clicked on each one and then it showed you, you know, a color and a size and a drop down of font faces, and you could make it look like however you wanted. And then same thing for H2, H3, you could make paragraphs look however you wanted. You could, you know, change all of your pre elements to use, you know, whatever. So, you know, like one of the things I think most of us did in those days when the first time we found this was like immediately made H1s tiny and H2s a little bit less tiny and H3s a little less tiny. And H6s were huge. And then go browsing in our app going, oh, that's hilarious. Look at the tiny little H1s. Okay. Let's put that all back. Cause this sucks. You know, but that's how it worked, right? The author had no way to say, this is what an H1 should look like. The author said, this is a level one heading, or if they were already like trying to break semantics, I want this to be big and bold. So I will put it in an H1, right? The user had control over what all this looked like. And that's been flipped, right, since then. I mean, yes, we have user style sheets, but, you know, me and 16 other people actually ever use them.
Right.
And, you know, nobody else ever does that. And those preferences went away. Like Netscape dropped those preferences when the whole team of Netscape basically left Mosaic and they were, like, redoing it. They said, okay, we're going to drop these because these are too complicated. We want this to be sort of mass market adopted.
They did have...
throw all these options at people in the mass market, they're going to be confused and they're going to be like, crazy computer techie stuff I don't understand. And they'll
and everything would look like Windows 3.1 with the black metal jacket or whatever. Do you remember those?
Yeah.
There was...
Hot dog stand.
Yeah. Okay. And you would... Everyone's computer looked horrible. You know, like show someone a Word document and it would be like green with purple type and
yeah.
It was before GeoCities. It was GeoCities before GeoCities. So they did leave some of those in though, right? They left in color. You could pick the color of links and visited links.
You're right.
And I think you could choose between serif and sans serif fonts.
Right. But basically at a document level.
Yeah. Right.
As opposed to like the way it used to be, where it was, you know, I want paragraphs to be in one font and hyperlinks to be in another one, and each one's to be in a third, you know, not that we had that many fonts, but still the option was there. Anyway, so sorry, I kind of got off.
Did you feel topic, like.
Which I do.
I mean, you must be very nostalgic for a lot of this stuff.
Sometimes.
When you look at what's happening now with Retina images and all that. Do you ever feel like, oh, get me off the merry-go-round? I've been here before. And like, do you feel like you know how things will play out and what the politics of it will be? And
see that? No, I don't think I ever feel like I know how things are going to play out. Except maybe at a high level where it sort of feels like, okay, we've done this before. And, you know, this is what we learned. You know, we learned X, Y, and Z the last time. And it feels like, you know, collectively we've forgotten X, Y, and Z. And so we're going to do this again. But I'm never quite sure if we're going to learn X, Y, and Z again, or if in fact we're going to decide that, you know, P, Q, and R are actually the way we're going to go with things, and then it will all be different.
So like last time we learned to be device agnostic, it was, let's be browser agnostic, right? Let's just design with standards. And we don't know whether people are going to take away, let's be device agnostic again, or let's really design for iPhone and this version of Android.
Yeah. I mean, you know, because they're not direct analogs. So it's always hard to know if exactly, you know, the same things will sort of obtain, because, you know, it used to be that we had different browsers, but they were all being accessed basically through the same channel, the same medium, the same channel, right? You know, it was, the whole question was, you know, what resolution does the, you know, is the user's monitor, but basically all the users were on monitors,
right?
On desks. And now that's really not the case. And when you switch your real world context or your physical world context, that does change the way you want to interact with your content a lot of times. You know, Luke Wroblewski talks about this at Event Apart a lot, where, you know, what you want when you go to the Apple Store website is different than maybe what you want when you're on your iPhone standing in an actual Apple Store, right? You don't necessarily want just to pull up the desktop web version of the Apple Web Store when you're standing in the store with your iPhone. You want to do something else.
Right.
And so, you know, that changes things.
Sure.
And I think in a lot of ways, it's going to take us a while to figure out exactly what that means. You know, this is for the first few years when content strategy was big, it was, gee, guys, we need to think about our content strategy. And now a lot more, it's you need to have a content strategy that adapts itself to multiple contexts, right? Right. And we kind of, I think, to me, that feels like a mirror of what we went through with web design, which was, you know, guys, we need to think about web design, right? We need to think about how we're doing this and why we need to do it right. And then, like, once that was basically settled, then it became, okay, now we have to think about how the design works in various situations. And anyway,
right.
I'm not really a designer, so a lot of this I observe from the outside.
You brag about that.
It's not a brag exactly. It's because of what I'm... It's a unique situation for me because I'm known for being the CSS guy. So I think there's a built-in assumption that, oh, and he's also a designer. And I'm not, right? And so it's not that I'm proud of not being a designer. It's that I want people, if I'm talking to them, to understand that, yeah, you know, I understand CSS. That doesn't necessarily mean that I understand how to do things visually, right? It's just that's the way that I am.
You're disclaiming.
Right? Yeah, in effect, I'm disclaiming because, you know, I mean, very occasionally I've had people say, why would you ever listen to such and so about CSS? He's a crap designer. Have you seen his stupid website? And it's like, yeah, my website has a very minimal design because that's pretty much the extent of my design chops. But it's more that, like, when I'm in conversation with people and they start talking about, you know, white space and the golden ratio and color theory, right? That stuff, and, you know, like picking the right font. Right. That stuff slides past me. It's like something that I don't instinctively grasp. And, you know, I had enough experiences where I would be in conversation with somebody and they would go off and my eyes would just kind of go cross each other. And I would say, I don't know what you just said. I'm sorry.
But you know, I mean, why would I listen to Jessica Hish about CSS? But people do. Right. I mean, that uses CSS is not what she's known for.
Right.
I think I would rather listen to her about type and color and things like that, and you about what does this, how is this supposed to function, and, you know, what are we looking at after floats? You know, I'd ask you about that.
Right, but, you know, I mean, we've known each other a long time, and you probably heard me say enough times that I'm not a designer, and realize that I'm not a designer because, you know, someone like you could certainly tell. You know, I do. I mean, I occasionally when typography comes up, it's not a brag so much as a disclaimer when I say that I can't at a glance tell the difference between Helvetica and Arial. And
right.
I know that there are people that me saying that is like fingernails on a chalkboard. They can't understand how anyone could possibly be so freaking blind that they couldn't see that. But I mean, yeah, when you put like the huge letter forms over top of each other, I can see where the differences are. But no, at a glance, I can't see it. And, you know, so.
Yeah, neither can most people.
Right? Like, I've taken the online quizzes that say, you know, is this Arial or Helvetica? And my answers are, I always get 50-50, right? I'm always half right, half wrong.
So you used to do a lot of experimentation on your site, like with ragging type around the shapes of objects and things like that. You've archived that stuff somewhere, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah.
Like, where would that be?
I try never to delete anything. That's one of my things.
You said before we started the show that you still had all the emails from the original CSS Samurai going back to, you know, 1998, whenever that was.
Yep.
And I'm not surprised because I think at a certain point when most people, when they migrate, move forward, they just go, okay, I lost those files, but you know what? I don't, I don't have SyQuest drives anymore. I don't have Zip drives anymore, Jazz drive, whatever it is. I don't, you know, Eudora was great, but I'm not using System 7 anymore, whatever it is. And they just lose stuff. I've lost a lot of stuff. I remember at a certain point thinking this stuff is priceless, and at another point going, F it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just, I've got to move on with my life. You seem to move on with your life just fine. Don't, I'm not saying you don't, but you do seem to have a very careful, conservative approach toward migration and conservation of things that you've worked on. And
yeah,
that's interesting to me.
Huh. Well, I mean, I have a degree in history. That's what I got my degree in college.
Okay.
So, you know, maybe there was already that sort of that instinct, but yeah, I do. I have a separate Eudora mailbox. I'm still using Eudora, which has meant that I'm still on Snow Leopard until I figure out how to move off of it without losing all of that data. Because yeah, I have the first mail that I got from Todd Farner on, I'm looking at it right now, August 26th, 1998, Title 7 CSS Samurai. And then I've got everything up through June of 2000. And if I might have more that simply hasn't been shuffled into that folder, or that might literally be the last mail that was sent, I would have to go look. But
would it be fair to publish that stuff?
That's an interesting question. I would want to talk to everybody who was part of that.
Who was there? Was John Alsop,
mm-hmm. Todd Farner, John Alsop, me, Braden McDaniel. Let's see. Shoku Omoto was at least involved. I think he had to drop out fairly early. A young lad named I.E. Hickson.
That's where, yeah.
And David Barron was also part of the group.
Yeah.
Sue Sims.
Yes.
And Jan Roland Erickson, I believe, was also a member. Liam Quinn. That was the one I knew I was blanking on somebody.
How did you meet? It was all done via mailing lists, private mailing lists?
Yeah, it was all mailing lists. A couple of these people I've never met in person. Even today, Braden McDaniel and Liam Quinn, I don't think I've ever met in person.
Where do they live?
I don't even know.
What are they doing now?
Again, I haven't heard from them in years. Actually, a lot of about half the samurai, which is a funny thing to say when there are seven, but
yeah.
About half of them, I haven't heard from in a really long time.
Todd Farner left the internet to become a bicycle developer.
Yeah, and I don't actually count him. I know what he's up to. But like Sue Sims and Jan Roland Erickson, I haven't talked to him forever. I'm not even sure, you know, what they're doing. Same thing with Braden and Liam. I tracked down as much information as I could find when I started on my podcast with Jen Simmons. And
tell me, you ran a podcast called...
So I'm actually part of the Web Ahead.
But you're the Web Behind.
Right, with Jen Simmons. But the shows that I do, we call the Web Behind because they're web history podcasts where we go back and we talk to, you know, Chris Wilson about the early days of Internet Explorer. Or, you know, in his case, being at NCSA with the NCSA Mosaic team and then moving on to other browsers and then eventually to Microsoft to work on Internet Explorer. Or, you know, I talked to John Alsop, was our first guest. And we talked about, you know, just sort of the cycles of web history. And Molly Holschlag was a guest. We talked about accessibility in the early web and stuff like that. But, you know, the idea being to talk to people who were there and to get their perspective, but also in some cases to, you know, talk about things that, you know, so many people who work on the web today just don't remember because they weren't part of the web.
Right.
You know, and when you think about it, if you talk to somebody, like if, you know, you went to dinner for a local meetup and you talk to somebody and said, hey, today is my, you know, my decade anniversary of being a web developer, 10 years, they started in 2003.
Right.
Right. Which is 10 years after the web became popular.
Right.
And so there's this, and if they missed the browser wars, right? Like they don't remember this site best viewed in badges. They don't remember like Blink versus Marquee and, you know, splash pages that asked you if you have this browser, click here. And if you have this browser, click there. Right. They missed
they don't,
all that.
They don't know why it's bad.
Well, it's not that they don't know why it's bad so much as they just, they didn't, you know, it's sort of like, you know, yes, I recognize that that's stupid because they exist in an environment where that was never necessary.
Right.
You know, there,
yeah. Chris Coyer, who was a guest on the show, this show, mm-hmm. and has his own excellent show. He did, he was running, a survey about what he runs CSS tricks. And right. he was doing a survey about what people knew about CSS, and a third of the correspondents had never heard of designing with web standards. Right? Mm-hmm. Never even crossed their mind. They'd never come across that book. So the whole idea that you had to fight for web standards or reason people away from doing table layouts, that's all gone. That's all gone. Right. And most of the people I work with have never done a table layout, which is...
Yeah, and probably most of them... like would have extreme trouble ever grasping why you would bother.
Right? But remember how hard CSS was once doing real layouts?
Yeah.
When we started?
Or tables and spacer gifs. I mean, that wasn't easy, right? Constructing those things was a pain and a half. But yeah, I mean, so, and another guest we had was Tom Bruce, who mm-hmm. like even veterans of the industry might not have heard of, but he wrote the first Windows web browser, right? Like before there was a Windows from Mosaic for Windows, he wrote Cello. And so like just hearing about, you know, he's not a computer programmer, right? So to talk to people who did things like, you know, I'm on Windows and I think this web thing is really useful, so I'm going to write my own web browser. Right, which it would be impossible today, basically. You know, and to hear about, you know, what went into that and why he stopped, you know, because he could see that things were becoming complex. You know, writing a CSS engine is a whole other level than writing, you know, just processing HTML and spitting out, you know, the sort of the default views. You know, so when you in JavaScript and all that kind of thing, it just became, you know, to write a browser is a huge thing now. It used to be a one man effort.
Yeah, yeah.
Potentially a one man effort.
Right, because like you said, it had to parse HTML.
Yeah.
Who's doing a good job teaching all the things you have to know now?
You know, I don't know. I think probably probably if I were to name sort of a, you know, you go to this site and you can learn everything, it would be sites like lynda.com.
Yeah.
You know, because they have just such a huge variety of content. So that you can, you know, learn HTML and then you can learn CSS and you can learn JavaScript, you know, learn PHP if that's the direction you're, you know, whatever things it is you need to know, you know. And, you know, Lynda has way more than just those things, obviously. I mean, right. They've got tons of content. Even if you're just measuring the electrons that you know, I think it's still tons now. It's amazing how much that Lynda's put together there. But it's other than that, there's a lot of catch as catch can, and also sites like Stack Overflow, I think, are where people learn now. It used to be that you joined a mailing list. And before that, it used to be that you joined a Usenet group.
Right.
And now it's you get a Stack Overflow account and you watch the tags that interest you. So if you're interested in CSS, you watch the CSS tags. Or more usually, you can't figure something out and you post it to Stack Overflow with a CSS tag. And within like 20 minutes, you have 16 answers, 14 of which are awesome. So that's another amazing community.
Which harkens back to a much earlier community, which you co-founded, a CSS mailing list.
Yeah, CSS Discuss. That's what CSS Discuss used to be like. It's gotten quieter over the years. I mean, it still has several thousand subscribers, but there's just mailing lists aren't like people don't join mailing lists anymore, basically.
No. Well, the web is more, it's more immediate. It's right there and you can keep referring back to it. Mailing lists have that problem that they're sort of like stuff you've got in a drawer instead of stuff that's taped to the wall, like a website.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not used to operating in that kind of environment, yeah, it does feel like, I mean, to me, email is not in a drawer, but that's, you know, I grew up in a different sort of milieu.
See, I grew up with email too, but you, when we're doing business together, you seem to be able to locate, you'll say, well, let me take up that thread again. Yeah, blah, blah. And I'm like, he just did that?
Yeah,
I mean, it takes me quite a while to find something, and you find it like it's like finding porn on Google. Yep, here's some porn. There you go.
That was an interesting analogy.
Thank you.
You're welcome. But again, right? I mean, that's because when I approach things like email, right, they're organized to be searchable. Like, you know, that to me is always key. And so, it's one of the reasons why eventually the web took off, right? Was, I mean, the web was really interesting and you could do really cool things on it, but then there was Google.
Right.
Well, you know, I mean, good search engines in general, Google happened to be the one that really took off at just the right time, but nonetheless, it's also in many ways still is a fantastic resource. I mean,
Google was the Google of search engines.
Yeah. Because, you know, it used to be that when, like, you found something, you bookmarked it. Like, bookmarking was really important because you needed to be able to find that thing again. Nobody bookmarks anymore, right? You just remember the three words that got you there the first time, and then you can Google that again.
Yeah, you don't even have to use a search form. You just type in the same field in which you would type a domain name. You just type the name of the website, and Google finds it for you, and you're done.
Right.
And have you used Bing at all? Do you like Bing?
I've used it. You know, I basically I use whatever my browser is set to default to, and it's still set to default to Google.
You don't change and customize the defaults of everything?
Oh, I do, but you know, I chose Google as the search engine that my browser was going to use, and I haven't had a reason to change it. It hasn't been like, you know, early on we switched search engines all the time because one search engine would become better than another. Like there was Dogpile, which nobody remembers. And then there was AltaVista, which was, I mean, like there was a substantive difference in the experience, right? Like you would search for something in Dogpile and you would get a few results, and then you would go to AltaVista and you would get dozens of results. I'm like, oh my God. And like, I only had to go two pages before I got to the thing that I was actually looking for. Right. And then after AltaVista, Google, you know, came along, and it was, oh my God, there were zillions of hits. And the thing I was looking for was the third result, right? I didn't have to look through any pages. Like that was a thing, right? When people started talking about how Google was so much better, I distinctly remember people saying, the thing I'm looking for is always the first page of results. I never have to click through like I do on, you know, older search engines. It's amazing. It's like, it's like it can read my mind or something. You know, however they manage that, but that was the perception. But like, we haven't really done that since because
they're all like that now. Yeah, you remember Yahoo too?
Yeah,
the other way of finding stuff.
Exactly, which was in its own way kind of like, you know, the drilling down the gopher pages because, you know, it was this big
or Usenet
hierarchy,
right?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, Usenet. Oh, Usenet.
Do you still have a Usenet account?
I don't think so. Okay. I there was only really one thing I ever went to Usenet for, which was Comp Info Systems World Wide Web Authoring Style Sheets, or CWAS.
Wow.
And it got really hostile. It was actually why I founded CSS Discuss, because CWAS eventually got to the point of someone would post a question and you know, they would basically get, you know, RTFM.
I'm so glad that internet discussions have gotten nice.
Well, and so I founded CSS Discuss specifically to be a, you know, when you ask a question here, you know, either you're not going to get an answer because nobody knows the answer, or you'll get an answer. And if someone's hostile, the list moderator will go chastise them in private and say, look, either cut that out or leave. Which is what I did.
How many years did you do that? How long were you the list mom of CSS?
Oh, I still
Discuss?
Am actually technically the list mom. So okay. It's, what year is this?
10
so
years?
It'll be 11 years by the end of this month.
Okay.
Because it was the end of January of 2002. And John Alsop actually provided a home for the list initially. And then when it sort of got crazy, we shifted over to eVault so that he didn't have to keep paying the bandwidth charges for what became a very, very active list. But he made that possible to start with. Always be grateful for that.
eVault, Workers of the Web, eVault.
Yep. I guess it's probably eVault, not eVault, but
what are some of those folks doing now?
Which folks?
The eVault folks.
Still doing their thing. So far as I can tell, I still have the same people that I email when I think the server's down that I was emailing when we've switched over, 9 years ago or whatever it was.
Isn't Adrian Holabody an eVault person, and aren't the EveryBlock people? No,
I'm not sure. There's so many dependencies now that it's hard to keep track of them all.
Where do you go, aside from an event apart, your own conference, where do you go to feel all webby inside? Where do you go to be with others of your kind? What conferences or events or meetups?
Twitter.
So you don't go any place physical in the world anymore.
Yeah. The thing is that,
three kids,
basically. We have actually a pretty good, active, group here in Cleveland, the Cleveland Web Standards Association, and they still meet monthly. And, I can rarely ever make it because it's like right during my kid's bedtime. And it's also usually on Tuesdays, which is one of the nights that Kat almost always works late. So it's hard for me to get there. I do make it when I can. And I'm thinking about starting up a lunchtime, once a month lunchtime kind of thing. I was going for a while, but that was back when we had like one kid. And, as the kids get older, like right now, our youngest, our son Joshua, is not quite two. He'll turn two relatively soon, right? So, like, as he gets to be four or five, and, the girls are commensurately older, then it'll be a lot easier again for, me to be out for an evening and for Kat to be on her own, or vice versa.
Happens really quickly.
Yeah. It does. Although I will say the whole like working at home thing, to me, I feel like it's slowed it down a lot.
Yes, you get to spend more time with them,
right? And like when my daughter comes home from school, I can, she's like, she comes in the door, she's like, "Hey, Dad," and, like, "Hey, how you doing? Do you have any homework that you need to get done? I can help with that if I've got a few minutes in the afternoon, as opposed to, having to do it in sort of that rush between dinner and bedtime, when everything's crazy." So, that's helped a lot, I think, with that. The flip side being that, because I don't go to an office and then like come home just in time for dinner and then have to pack everything in between dinner and bedtime, I can be home to do that stuff. But then the flip side, of course, is, that when I go, quote unquote, go to work, like when I leave the house to go to work, it's usually to get on a plane and go to a different city or sometimes even a different country. And so like I'm gone for 5 days, I'm just completely gone. And so, it can be stressful, but that's the trade-off, right? And I'm always aware of that trade-off. It's, I can be here now, but that means that like next month I'll be gone for most of a week, or, in such and so, 3 months from now, I will be gone for a week because I have two things that I'm doing simultaneously, one right after another, and I'll be gone for 8 days. But
I'm a patient father in part because I'm old, but also just because obviously we're patient because we love our children, but I'm patient because I also know I can sit and have like lots of downtime with my daughter, lots of downtime that, another adult my age might be bored. I'm not bored. And I also know that soon I'll have plenty of excitement, right? That, soon I'm going to be changing planes in Milan or something. And so I'm not, I kind of relish just the ability to recharge my batteries and be, just have downtime with my daughter. And it's really another kind of creative work anyway.
Yeah. And yeah, it really is great. And, you know, and we're in that interesting valley right now. Like, it's really easy when you have like one kid and they're 6 months old. Like, your sleep schedule is disrupted, but they're, you know, you can put them down. And then when you come
like
back,
backpacks.
They're in the same place.
Yeah. Where
or you can put them in a backpack or something. Yeah, exactly.
But they are like backpacks. You just strap them on and go meet people for dinner. And, you know, they might need some milk. That's about it.
Right. And then, you know, once they get to be past, you know, four or five or, you know, terrible threes or whatever period that is, once they get to sort of the six, seven, eight range, they become a lot more self-reliant and independent, which, you know, can cause a few bits of wistfulness, but, you know, it's also really, it's that period between where they're like, yeah, it's, that's where so far a lot of the demands have been. Of course, there are probably people listening who are thinking, yeah, wait till they're teenagers. But
well, I remember
I haven't been there yet.
When Carolyn was a baby and Ava was a baby and we were pushing them in baby strollers at South by Southwest, you and me, and someone tweeted, I just saw Eric Meyer and Jeffrey Zeldman go by pushing baby strollers. Which wouldn't happen today at South by Southwest because nobody would know who we were, for starters. Which is kind of nice. It's kind of nice to be anonymous at South by Southwest.
Yeah. Well, and also, how would they see us in the crowd of 25,000 people?
There's that.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I've realized that I never actually answered one of your first questions, which was, how did I get to be known? And like I say, it was being in the right place at the right time because I was this university webmaster, so I was... I went to some early like the WWW conference series. So I went to the one in Chicago, the second.
Who ran those?
I don't remember if the International World Wide Web Conference Committee had yet been formed by the second. Probably had been. So it was the IW3C2, not the W3C. And I believe they still do, although I haven't checked recently. But like the second one, which was in... like I say, in Chicago, it was in downtown Chicago, and it was right after Netscape had been founded. And like literally the whole company was there because the whole company was, you know, 16 people or something like that. Like, Mark, you know, you would pass Mark Andreessen in the hallway, hey, Mark, you know, that kind of thing. And Mark Pesci was there presenting about VRML, and Tim Berners-Lee was probably there somewhere. I don't remember now, but it was in Chicago, and like, you know, I lived in Cleveland. So Jim, the coworker of mine who had first introduced me to the web, he and I got approval to like drive to Chicago and attend this conference. And then we drove back, and it was so amazing, everything. And so anyway, so I got really like invested in the web, and this is like, you know, this is 1994. So I wanted to be the webmaster. I wanted us to have our own website, not just a web front end to a Gopher server. And we got that to happen. And so that started to happen. And I was working on things, and I came across CSS really early, like 1996, and was trying to use it and couldn't figure out how to use it. So I started creating all these support pages. Like, I created a test suite because I wanted to know, okay, does this work? Like, does this browser support this thing? Because I feel like I'm doing
how
this right.
How did you know how to create a test suite?
I just did it. I don't know. I didn't know.
You read the spec and said, I think this is what that means, and I... Or did you say, well, I'm not sure what it means. Let's write this and see what happens.
It was mostly the youthful hubris of the former, where it was this is how this should work, but it doesn't seem to be working when I do it like this. So I'm just going to create this very focused test case and see if, you know, is it that like if you combine color with font, something goes wrong? Or is it just that this thing doesn't support font or whatever? And so having created those and, you know, started to collect this information that I was tracking for myself, I just tossed it up on the web to say, you know, here's what the CSS support in various Mac browsers is. And that got me noticed by Web Review, which was a web magazine at the time. And
yeah,
I started writing for them, and they housed the support charts, which I then expanded to be cross-platform. So
again, you created those.
Yeah. In fact,
that was the first thing of yours that I saw, I think. Although you were already on the CSS Samurai, so I'd already seen emails from you, but that was the first work of yours that I saw, I believe.
Okay. Well, the first work I'd really done was I wrote some HTML tutorials in 94, 95, and I tossed them up on the web, and they became weirdly popular. But then I was doing the CSS support stuff, and it got, there was all this, it was like the first cross-browser CSS support chart, and I It was actually, everything was stored in a FileMaker Pro database, and I had written these like gnarly export views that I could then save as HTML or save as text, I'm sorry, and then put up on the web. And the web review guys, it turns out, had their cubes right next door to the O'Reilly guys. Like, their cubicle farm was right next to the O'Reilly cubicle farm. So when O'Reilly went looking for a CSS author, they wandered next door to the web review guys and said, do you know anybody who knows this CSS thing? And it turns out the web review guys did. And it was me.
Hilarious.
So,
and serendipity again.
Right, exactly. I mean, it was like, I was most of the way through a proposal for a CSS book that I was going to send to O'Reilly when that happened. So it's possible that it might have happened anyway, but I was also really lucky. You know, the O'Reilly guys got in touch with me and said, we'd like you to write a CSS book. And I said, I would love to. And it was really weird because at the time, like O'Reilly, you know, maybe starting out authors still feel this way, but O'Reilly was like the pinnacle, right? Like, you write an O'Reilly book and basically you're done.
Yeah.
Your career is over. You can turn off the lights.
Wow. Right?
You've made it.
You've made it, yes.
And so I had thought that I would maybe write some books for other publishers to prove that I was worthy of being an O'Reilly author. And I ended up starting there. Oops. But yeah, again, it was luck that I got started on all these things early enough and somebody noticed them and was interested in them, you know. But you have similar stories about how you happen to be in the right place at the right time and you just took something and ran with it and people noticed, right? And lots of other people that I talked to who got started out, you know, at similar times, you know, it's there seems to me to be a fairly common thread, which is, you know, I happened to stumble across something and I got really lucky and I worked really hard to follow up on those opportunities.
I ran with it and got obsessed. Seems to be the common thread.
Yeah.
You know, almost unhealthily obsessed, because I think, unfortunately, that seems to be part of it. I don't know how you, well, I think now in our gentlemanly years, we can have more of a work-life balance, family and work balance. But I know for me, when I was, when I plunged into the web at first, I was just like, you know, rolled out of bed and started working.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
I'm glad it's different now.
Yeah, it's nice. Then there's a lot more to know now too, right? I mean, back when you and I were doing that sort of obsessive, you know, dawn to dusk kind of web stuff.
It
was possible to know everything.
It was possible to know everything.
Yeah. Whereas now that would be really, really hard, you know. That's the way it is with, I think, any successful system, right? It starts out, and usually they start out simple and then they just get more and more complex as more and more things get sort of subsumed into them. And I mean, I think that was part of why, you know, you and I founded In a Fin Apart, was to help people, you know, learn more about all this stuff, right? To be able to be more expert.
Help me learn.
Yeah, no kidding.
I don't think people realize, and a lot of times I feel like if I have something to say, it's only because I've been going to my own conference for a while. We just launched a redesign of An Event Apart, and we just launched a schedule of 8 shows for the year. What's exciting you nowadays? What kind of gets you all charged up?
Let's see. Web-wise, I would say really, well, within my particular purview of expertise, if you want to call it that, within CSS, it's really advanced layout, things like Flexbox and grid layout. Flexbox is really picking up a lot of steam, and grid layout is being worked on pretty hard.
How are you involved in those things, and how do you?
I'm actually not.
So how do you learn about those things?
I try to watch the discussions on WWW Style, which mailing list, although it's really, it's pretty high traffic. And so it can be tough to keep up. Fortunately, they have conventions that help with that.
You know, you said a moment ago that, you know, nowadays nobody uses mailing lists, but you're wrong. The W3C uses them. That's who uses them.
That's true.
And Hixi uses them. What working group?
Yeah, right. But I wouldn't be surprised if there were a number of web interfaces to those mailing lists that, like, people just only ever interacted via the web interface and, like, never actually via a mail client. But the W3C does still make heavy use of mailing lists. And, you know, I would make heavier use of mailing lists if there were, you know, mailing lists to make use of, but there just aren't that many anymore. But I try to watch there and, spec versions, really. When a new version of a spec comes out, you know, looking to see what changed can tell you a lot about where things are going.
How do you feel about the fact that CSS, like HTML, will now kind of never be finished, that it's not another monolithic version and then 10 years and then another monolithic version, but that it's all these modules that are, you know, may get finished, may not, may change a lot, may be released soon the way, I mean, how do you keep up with that? And does that make you hopeful about the web?
I actually like it a lot better. Given everything that CSS covers now, because in the days of CSS1, sure, you could have an entire 54-page spec, right? That was like all of CSS1. And then CSS2 was a couple hundred pages. And even then we were thinking, oh, this is kind of big. Like if you were to take all of the CSS modules now and print them out, I mean, you're probably talking, you know, 1,000 pages, maybe more. I don't know if anyone's actually done it. But the great thing is that, well, there's a lot of great things, but one of the great things is that no area of interest, is dependent on work in other areas. So with CSS2, you know, it might have been really important to work on positioning, right? And so you would work on that. But then there were all these other chapters that had to be worked on before you could call it done, right? So then positioning, like nothing would happen with positioning or, you know, floats or font face or whatever, right? Because you were working on RL CSS, right? And that chapter had to be finished before you could push the spec out the door. Right. Now it's, you know, selectors is already on version 4. You know, they're not done, but they're into the drafts, you know, like working drafts of version 4 of selectors. Whereas, generated content for print is not advancing as fast. And if it ever becomes important, then it can advance faster. Like there can be a concentration on that, but it doesn't hold up anything else. Right. So, you know, grid layout and flexbox can be pushed forward, you know, basically as fast as the working group and the implementers can make it happen. And
what will those things do to all the frameworks that are out there? Will they just make them?
That'll be interesting. Cause a lot of the frameworks do, like, the core of a lot of those CSS frameworks seems to be, we're going to define a list of 700 classes that will handle all these various grid spanning things. And I mean, I suppose you could still do that. But, you know, creating a grid and attaching things to it, at least in the grid layout spec, just becomes so much easier. It's weird looking at the syntax and thinking, wow, it's amazing how much they've managed to pack into this, and how much is possible. For that matter, the related spec CSS exclusions, which was an Adobe proposal, and which WebKit has turned on for nightlies, I think, or maybe it's gotten further than that now. But exclusions is basically a way of doing things like the ragged float, right? That we came, you know, 12 years ago, however long ago it was, where we were slicing up images to stack them and float them. And then you could have, you know, text sort of flowing along that outline. The CSS exclusion spec makes it possible to have those kinds of effects without having to slice anything, where you can have an element and then you can define the regions of the element, which, you know, create exclusions. And then
almost like what were that very early visual.
Wow. Image maps.
Image maps, yes.
Uh-huh. Yep. Actually, anyone who remembers polygonal shapes and image maps will at least see some echoes of that syntax in the exclusion spec. But the interesting thing about the exclusion spec is that it leads you to some very sort of fascinating effects. Like if you have two elements which you've absolutely positioned so they overlap, and then you set them both to like exclude, which one excludes the other depends on their Z index. So the one that's on top creates an exclusion zone for the one behind it. So just by flipping the Z index, you change the way that the content gets laid out. It's fascinating stuff, right?
Wow.
At least to me. And so,
you could on hover completely change a layout as just one example.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, you could do that anyway, but,
no, but
you could, yeah,
ragged.
I called it ragged float, and then there was super ragged float, and sandbags was the list of part article that was an advancement of that technique. Sandbagging, I think. Anyway, it's just, but I mean, exclusions are important, right? Because if you're going to have all of these various elements that you're attaching to a grid, you know, and you don't know necessarily how long or short they'll be, you have to be able to say, okay, you know, the content of this one wraps around the shape of that one. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so exclusions are really important for that sort of thing, to be able to make those sorts of definitions. There's a lot more power to them. They also provides the ability to say for an image that the text should wrap around it either to one side or the other side or to both sides. So you can have the thing where you have a column of text that comes down to an image and then it
wraps
flows
on either side.
Yeah, it flows to the left, and then it continues flowing to the right, and then below the image, it just keeps going as a full column, right? And there's just, like, you can just...
All the way down to the left and then go up and fill in all the way to the right, or would it fill across?
That's more... I believe it's... I think you might be able to pick. I don't know for sure. And, you know, because exclusions are still in development, anything we say today, you know, could be different later, you know? Like it could be invalidated by changes that happened down the line. You may be able to pick between those two though. And then there's CSS regions, which Adobe has also proposed, which is a whole other thing,
which you like.
Yes and no. The interesting thing about regions is it lets you basically define how content flows from one region of your layout to another. Okay. So the way that you end up laying out pages, if you have a regions aware browser, which really none of them are, except I think maybe Nightly's and WebKit. I haven't looked recently.
Gecko, Presto, Trident, and WebKit, I believe.
All do regions?
Have some, or there are tests for at least.
Oh, okay. That could be. Anyway, whatever. What you end up with is you end up with a div that, or other section or whatever element that has all of your content, like the entire page. And then you have this skeleton with no content in it, where you sort of describe, you have one element per layout piece. And then with regions, you basically tell the browser to pick up all the content that was in that one element and flow it through these other elements, which you have sized using whatever layout you've used. It doesn't depend on any particular
and
layout.
And it's flexible as well, right? You could use M's.
Well,
percentages. I
mean, basically the point of regions is here's how you can make content flow from one piece to another, but how those pieces are laid out, that happens somewhere else, whether you're using grid layout or flexbox or floats or positioning, not our concern, right?
Oh,
regions is just about, here's how this works. Here's how you do this flow, right? Where you get to the end of one element and then you just pick up with your content at the beginning of the next element in your flow chain, basically.
Okay.
So, right.
So you could really have a multi-column responsive design with a photograph in the middle, but you can then tell it, this is the flow from this region to this region to this region, and the text will wrap like it would in a sophisticated print magazine.
Right.
Not that this is always a great device or web experience for reading. This might be an impressive technology that's actually ill-suited to the web.
It's possible. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely one of those things that you look at and you think, wow. Well, it's kind of like multi-column CSS, mm-hmm. which has had some support in a number of browsers for quite a while now, but very few people use it on the web because you don't really want to have to scroll down to the bottom of the first column and then scroll back up to the top of the second column and scroll down to read it and then scroll back up to the top of the right.
I mean, no, you do not, sir.
Right. Nobody wants to do that. But it's great in print, right? If you want a two-column print.
Because your eye is doing it. You're not.
Well, right. Because you can, in theory, you can see the whole piece of paper.
You see the whole piece of paper at once, right?
Right. Which is what, I mean, print's great for that. And so, yeah, it's Regions is one of those things that strikes me as, wow, you know, you could really do really awful things to the user with this. But my experience over the years has been that the stuff that we look at and the first thing we think is, oh my God, we could really hurt the user with this. There's always stuff that you can really do to make the user happy buried in there. And sometimes you don't see it for, you know, like it's not noticeable first, you know, kind of like, 1980s desktop typography, right? The era of the ransom note newsletter, right? Where people had these programs they could use to create, you know, newsletters on their Macs, and they had access to all these fonts. And so they used every single frickin' font, right?
Yeah, we're back to Blue Metal Jacket or whatever that was.
Yeah.
Black Leather Jacket, I think it was.
Right. So like people would do that, and it got to be, right, and it got to be such a cliche. It's like, oh, geez, did you use every single font or did you leave off one or two when you created this newsletter, right?
You missed a font.
Different freaking font, right? But then, you know, that's what we see first. And then later, with all of those fonts, you know, people get that out of their system or whatever, and then they start designing these really beautiful newsletters using, you know, really tasteful fonts, you know. And the same kind of thing can happen, I think, with regions. It's easy to see the potential for abuse and not always easy to see how it might actually solve problems. And in some cases, it might solve problems we don't know that we have yet, right? Like with portable devices, not necessarily single handheld devices, but things like iPads or Kindle Fires or Microsoft Surface type computers, right? There might be user interaction problems we haven't even figured out that they are problems yet. And so these sorts of things like exclusions and regions and grid layout and stuff like that could well be solutions to the problems we haven't discovered yet, as well as the solutions to problems that we know that we have. And, you know, those usually we can see, oh my God, if I had grid layout, I could totally create, you know, like a Windows 8 style interface with just a few lines of CSS, and it would just, you know, work, and it has fallback, and it's fantastic, right? Like that, those sorts of solutions we can see. But I, you know, in a lot of cases, it's the what's interesting is when we discover a new problem and then try to figure out, okay, how are we going to solve this one? And in a lot of cases, the powerful tools that we already have, you know, have what we need to solve those problems.
Which is why we have to keep advancing this technology and learning about it.
Right.
To solve the problems we don't know we have yet. Or the problems we will. I have a problem right now, which is that we are out of time. I love this and I want to have you back. This was great. Thank you for your time today.
Oh, thank you. It was great. Like you, I would love to do it again soon.
Cool. And let us also thank Shutterstock.com. And remember that you can sign up for Shutterstock.com with no credit card and get 30% off any package by using the offer code BigWebShow1. BigWebShow numeral 1. That's our show. Thanks, everybody. See you again soon.